I think coaching somebody to success is actually easier to feel good about than finishing off an event like the Royal. My brain, the way it operates, won't ever let me think I've done perfect or it's been perfect. Like, all I look at are the things that maybe I could have done better or something where I misjudged and made a mistake. So that's how I operate during the event. After the event, I can look at it and go, yeah, it was a good event. We did a good job. But there's always that but in the back of mind. I need to do this. I need this. We need to improve that. I need to make notes on that. So for me, it's a lot easier to stand back and just coach somebody and really support their desire for success, whatever that looks like for them, whatever their benchmark is, really support that when they go in the ring. That's easier for me.
There is a depth and a breadth to our lives that largely goes unexplored. As an equestrian life mindset coach and host of this podcast, I am here to lead you on that exploration. Deep conversations covering topics in and out of the show ring with industry leaders and unsung heroes alike, sharing their stories and what makes their journey unique, but relatable at the same time. We all have stories to share and lessons to trade. Something we've learned from a horse or from each other. So relax and be ready to listen with more than just your ears. I'm Tracy Mitchell. Welcome to Hitting Your Stride. When you spend your life dedicated to horses, you can bet it's going to teach you a lot about yourself and the world around you. Christine Rupka has been taking notes and learning as much as she can during her journey while enjoying it along the way. Christine is the current director, equestrian and breed sport at the Royal Horse Show, where she oversees all components of competition and entertainment for Canada's premier indoor horse show. Additionally, their 35-year veteran of equestrian sport has competed at several levels, become an Equestrian Canada judge in jumper, hunter, hack and equitation, and has her level 1 FEI jumper judge status. As a member of the Ontario Equestrian Board of Directors, Christine has worked to ensure the sustainability of all equestrian industry and sport through the mentorship, education, and skills advancement programs for junior and adult athletes. Her passion for the sport, the desire to compete, to teach, and to enter event management helps with her devotion to paying it forward to make sure that the sport remains in good and capable hands for future equestrians. This is a great conversation with someone who brings unique perspective to our sport, and I am sure I could have Christine Rupka back as many more times to share the wealth of experience and information about the benefits of hard work and dedication. For now, help me in welcoming her to Hitting Your Stride. Well, welcome Christine Rupka to Hitting Your Stride. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. All right, Christine. Well, let's get started here because I hear you're getting ready to go on a cruise.
Yeah, I am. I am flying out in about 10 hours. So
awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So I would like to start with you telling me what these three values mean to you and what they should mean to all equestrians: integrity, humility, and honesty.
Oh, those are three big ones. Three really, really important words as far as I'm concerned. And there are things that I kind of work really hard to live by. I mean, some are easier than others at different times, but integrity for me means, you know, you're taking the high road at all times. Even if it's not the best for you personally, you can keep your own integrity and you keep your reputation intact, because in the end, when we all get buried or whatever, that's all you have left is your name and your reputation. So integrity for me means taking the high road and always keeping your moral compass in line. Honesty, I mean, honesty ties in very closely with integrity, right? Because you can't have integrity without honesty. And I think there's two different types of honesty. There's the honesty that you have with the outside world. Being honest with them, with whether it's your clients, your friends, your family, you know, you have to be honest there, but you also have to be really honest with yourself. And I think for me, you know, sometimes asking yourself, did I do the best I could possibly do? Did I shirk my responsibilities? You have to be really honest with yourself about that. It's hard sometimes, but, you know, that keeps you driving forward. And humility is so, so important. And that's one I really, you know, endeavor to put forward every day. I think that you can't underestimate the importance of being humble and having some humility. Like, it doesn't matter how much you win, doesn't matter how much money you make, in the end, we in this sport, we're not doing anything special. We're not curing cancer. We're not, getting the Nobel Prize for Peace because we brokered a deal between warring nations. We've got farm animals jumping sticks, and some people are getting paid really well for that, and we should really, we're just another cog in the wheel. And over grand scheme of life, our industry is just another business, and that's, what it is.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, you've been a lot of places. You've seen a lot of, you've met and seen and watched a lot of riders, etc. What, and th with the young ones coming up, what do you think you pieces of advice that you might give to help them keep humility in perspective?
I think, for me, some of the things I get disappointed in, whether it's with the young professionals or the younger athletes coming up, there's a real lack of wanting to do their own work and wanting to put in the time and, and to get the education, the behind the scenes. I think trainers should all muck their own stalls at some point in time. You don't have to muck a whole barn every single day, but you know what? If your staff are behind or if you're short of staff, you can't be afraid to pick up a pitchfork. You can't be afraid to clean your own tack. And for the younger riders, they should be learn how to bandage your own horse, learn how to do all that stuff. Don't expect to walk to the ring, show up and get on your horse and go in the ring for your 2 minutes of fame. I think those are the two biggest disappointments for me when I look at the state of affairs today in our sport. But I
Okay.
think that would be my advice. You've got to learn to put in the time and put in the work. There's no easy way forward. It's you have to put in the
Exactly.
time.
Awesome. Okay. Totally agree. All right. So it's been 35 plus years for you in equestrian sports, and you've been involved as a competitor, coach, judge, and manager. How has one role led to the next and helped you prepare for your next challenge at each step?
Oh my, your questions are good, and I have to think about them. And you also reminded me how old I am too, 35 plus years. I'm like, ooh, that's
Sorry.
a long time. So as a competitor, I showed when I was younger as an amateur and then turned professional. And as a competitor, regardless of what level you're showing at, you learn to be humble because every time you get a high spot and you win a class, the next class or the next day, all of a sudden you're sitting in the middle of the oxer. So it teaches you how to win and lose with grace, I think, as a competitor. As a coach, I what I learned the most as a coach is that, my outlook on horse sport wasn't everybody's outlook on horse sport. Like some of my clients, and I had some older lady clients who had ridden when they were younger, gone away to university, gotten married, had kids, and then now were wanting to get back in the sport. Their goals were not to be champion at every horse show. Their goals were to like really enjoy their time with their horse and to have fun at the horse show. So for me, I had to learn to take the pressure off them because I like to win. And their important ideas were different than mine. What was important to them was different than what was me. So that taught me a lot of empathy. As a judge, you really learn about the value of your name and the integrity, and also, how to make hard decisions. When I first started officiating, I remember my, very first horse show after I got my card. I mean, I had like 13 or 14 kids in the class. I wanted to give everybody a ribbon, and I made myself crazy scoring because I had all these 0.5s, 0.25s because I'm like, oh, that one was just a little bit better. I made myself crazy because I wanted everybody to succeed and wanted to give everybody a ribbon. So I learned to make hard decisions there. As a competition manager, I mean, particularly as it pertains to the Royal, you learn people skills were something I've learned, and I've learned how to approach sensitive topics or topics I want to sway somebody's opinion on in a more delicate fashion. And I mean, nobody will ever accuse me of not saying it like it is, but you learn how to manage people's expectations and manage the conversation so you don't, come across quite as aggressive. The as a manager, it's also really heightened my sense of business. It's really improved my financial skills and my strategic planning. So, often when I talk to young professionals or people, and I say, "What's your business model?" and they kind of go blank. And maybe you need to change your business model. If you don't want to make the royal, if you don't want to go to every horse show on the face of the earth, tell your customers, "These are the horse shows we're going to." And maybe have two or three horse shows in reserve that, if the royal is a focus for somebody, they can qualify. But you might lose a couple of customers, but you always have your integrity and your personal mantra intact at that point, right? And then they're gonna end up happier because they go somewhere where what they want to do is more a focus, and then you'll end up with new customers. So it all works itself out. But business and business acumen is a big thing, what I've learned from the Royal. And that's been I've been really grateful for that.
That's awesome. And I totally agree. I mean, that last part that you mentioned there, clients come and go. I mean, I totally experienced that in my massage business for 24 years. There's an ebb and a flow to everything. It doesn't mean it's coming to an end. It doesn't mean you have to panic and then sacrifice those values. And the other part that you mentioned that in the last couple of episodes I've done, the concept of business in the equestrian world is something that I really like to talk about. I like to promote. I like to open up people's minds to, because I think a lot of horse people just think they're doing horse things. They don't put together the fact that it's a business as well. And it's and I love talking to the young riders, or like the young professionals coming up, and just sort of picking their brain and see where they're at as far as how they view what they're doing. And maybe they could be looking into a couple of things that might actually set them up for more success.
Agreed, agreed. And I'm always about treating the horse show as a place of business. So turn yourself out accordingly, dress accordingly. Spaghetti strap tank tops for me have no place in the warm-up ring. Dress properly. Won't keep your paddock boots clean all day, but show up with your paddock boots polished and clean, and tuck your shirt in before you go to the ring. I mean, these are small things, but people stand at the rail and customers stand and watch other people. And if you look like you have it together, that they automatically assume you do. Whether you do or not is irrelevant. But at least turn yourself out properly and look like a professional, because there is a standard uniform. It's unspoken, but there's a standard uniform to wear to the horse show as a professional or a coach.
Yeah, exactly. I agree upon that. What do you feel has changed the most in your time being involved with high-level equestrian sport? And do you feel that has changed the way you see it or feel about it in any way?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting. Having now been around so many high level athletes, I've had conversations with, some of the top 10 athletes in the world in show jumping, and I've had the privilege of kind of just watching them from behind the scenes, and just observing. And I think you really learn about the dedication of the athletes and the time they put in. They're at the top of the sport, not because they have clients that can, buy them the most expensive horses. They're at the top because they worked really hard 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and they put in the time, and they're always thinking of, what can I do better? What can I do better for my horse? It's not, I don't really ever hear, "Well, my horse champed." No, you don't ever hear the top saying, "Oh, the horse was bad." It's interesting. I mean, somebody, McLean Ward is a perfect example. I mean, he is wired to win. And I actually was in a cab with McLean and his family one night, and going back to the hotel from the Royal, we agreed to share a cab. And he was so angry at himself because of how he rode in a class. And I mean, he was third, and it was a good class. Like, you wouldn't think that he rode, but he spoke about his errors. He let his horse down. Wasn't going to let it happen again for the rest of the week. And he came back, later in the week and won the World Cup. But it was interesting just to listen to him and his mindset. And he's got the mindset of a winner and always analyzing, always thinking. So, that's the one thing. I've also learned about the importance of the behind the scenes people, specifically the ones who don't get the glory, the grooms. They are the internal support team that keeps all the wheels going. They are the first line of defense against injury on a horse. and I don't think they're given enough credit, to be honest. And the last thing I feel a business overall is really poorly run. I think we're low on integrity in a lot of instances across the board in different, for some of the things I've heard and whatever, but I think their business needs a better overhaul and to be better run. We need to look at the sport as pure sport, but what you're doing at most of the level that we operate on is business, right? So I think that
It does seem to
really.
go back to that. And to touch on, like, over the years with some of the higher level riders whose horses I've massaged, one of the things that I consistently noticed with them, the good ones, that their relationship with their horse was their paramount goal, right? To really get to know them, to understand them in certain situations. Off, like, in the saddle and out of it. I've got some heartwarming, memories popping through my brain right now, going, oh yeah, like there's it's something different and it's special. And then the grooms, my gosh, when I go into a barn, they're the people. Yes, I understand they're not the ones paying the bills or riding these horses, but they're the ones that are busting their buns and, helping me out and everything. So yes, I don't think they get enough kudos in a lot of cases, but yeah, they're really important.
Yeah, and I don't know, any riders at the top level that are not horsemen. They're not riders that step on and go to the ring and horse show. They are horsemen, and they get on their horse within 5 minutes. They know what kind of day they're going to have, and a lot of them go walk in the barn and go, "Today I have a problem with this way." You know what I mean? It's sharp, it's fresh, or whatever. But yeah, it's and they look for things to help their horse. If they have a problem jumping open water, they go and they school the open water. They just don't, expect it to be right the next time. They try and ensure success. So,
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, is the sense of accomplishment you get coaching someone to personal success in the ring the same as what you get after staging a well-run, high-level event? And how do you allow yourself to celebrate those successes while still using them to learn and grow?
oh, gosh. I think coaching somebody to success is actually easier to feel good about than finishing off an event like the Royal. My brain, the way it operates, won't ever let me think I've done perfect or it's been perfect. Like, all I look at are the things that maybe I could have done better or something where I misjudged and made a mistake. So that's how I operate during the event. After the event, I can look at it and go, "Yeah, it was a good event. We did a good job." But there's always that but in the back of mind. I need to do this. We need to improve that. I need to make notes on that. So for me, it's a lot easier to stand back and just coach somebody and really support their desire for success, whatever that looks like for them, whatever their benchmark is. Really support that when they go in the ring. That's easier for me. I think it's I always question myself, and but I don't do that as much in the training or coaching.
Yeah, and I think that would make sense. And I think you're the event planning, that's a much longer, larger frame of time, isn't it? As far as, like, it takes a large amount of stress and packs it into 10 days. That's all the us visitors see is the 10 days. But yeah, that requires a lot of your time.
It does. And I mean, planning something like the Royal is a full year thing. It's not a, it's not like a normal horse show where it's a 10-day event, or a 5-day event. First of all, you have 10 days, but we have so many breeds, so many disciplines. And to me, each one is as important as the other. The show jumping is our premier because it sells the tickets. But the 6-horse hitches, people come for that too. And that's an important group. People come to the breed show because they're, looking to invest in a certain breed or looking for a successful stallion to breed to. So it's all important. But a funny thing for the Royal is, it's just not anxiety and stress for 10 days. It starts, we ratchet up like Labor Day this weekend coming is when it really starts because for the staff at the Royal, when we go into the office, when we go into the office, and the CNE is setting up the Canadian National Exhibition. When that is setting up on Exhibition Place, we go, "Oh God, it's getting close." And then once the CNE is done and they start tearing it down, You can feel the anxiety in the office and the tension grow. Like it's automatically. It's really interesting.
Wow. Yeah, it's just those triggers that you need to see that tell you, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah, agreed.
In a business that needs to be detailed down to the last small item, how do you define success without letting success be what defines you?
This, to be honest, it's really a problem for me. My self-worth a lot of times is defined by the success, and it's not necessarily my own personal success, like for the Royal. If we have a good Royal and I hit the revenue targets and the sales of tickets targets and we hit the right number of entries, then I feel successful because I've helped create something successful. So it's hard for me to define success without being my own definition. I don't know if that makes sense. I feel like I'm, oh, how do I put it? I feel like my self-worth is often tied to whether what I put in is successful. And it's hard. It's hard to kind of say, well, you know what? You had no control over that part of the item, so it's not on you. But I'll talk myself into that. Well, you could have done this or you could have done that. And so, nobody has to berate me. I'm really good at doing that on myself. And that's, part of my wanting to be wired as a winner.
Yes, and the whole perfectionism label usually gets attached to that as well.
Yeah, it is the German in me for sure as well.
Yeah, and I think honestly, I mean it's wonderful, and thank you for sharing that about yourself, because I don't think people can be very open or very raw with stuff like that. I mean, I'll fully admit, when I first started massaging 20 plus years ago, and I refer to the Canadian team riders as the red coats. Like every time I, got another person in a red coat that represented Canada as a client, it's like, oh, okay, here we go, here we go. And then I remember, I don't know, it was probably five or six riders in, and then I had a little moment. I'm like, Trace, this does not define who you are as a person, as a massage therapist, as your own personal success and how you're walking through life. And I think it would be like, again, it's one of those things that I think everybody could kind of benefit from being aware of that.
Yeah, agreed, agreed. And I think in the society we live in now, it's hard. I always say people don't love a winner, right? Because if somebody loses a class and gets thrown on the ground, they're really easy to empathize with because they're no longer a competitor against you, right? But when somebody's winning all the time, people look for reasons that they shouldn't be winning all the time, and it's hard. We're a society that's quick to judge and quick to point fingers at other people and demean them and berate them, and I think that's really hard. As the human race goes, it's we need to do better, right? We need to support each
Absolutely.
other and be and support success, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So tell myself and the listeners all about you and the Royal. When did your journey with putting together the Royal start, and how has it evolved? And what, like you mentioned, it's a year-long thing. Can you sort of fill us in a little bit on all that?
Yeah, so it was a funny story. My business model when I was a full-time professional horseman, my business model was not to charge so much money and have them just show up with a horse tacked up standing in the cross tie. So that's not something I believed in. And I didn't want those clients because that financial participation comes with a lot of expectations, and that's and I don't believe in people showing up and just getting on. So my business model, everybody had to bandage their own horses. They were expected to bathe their own horses. They were expected to clean their own tack. And my business model, I taught 4 days a week, and I included it all in one board price, which was quite low by standards of the industry at the time. But I felt very strongly about, if you want 4 lessons a week, I'll give you 4 lessons a week. But here are the times that you have to arrive at and be on your horse by, like each day, right? So I would say, you know, I taught Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. You need to be on your horse, you know, in the off season when we weren't showing, you need to be on your horse Sunday, no later than 1:30. Because for me, I worked 7 days a week. My thing was to be out of the barn by, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that was my business model. As time went on, it became harder and harder to make the revenue that I needed to you know, support myself and be able to feed myself and, you know, and take care of the horses in a way that I thought we should do. So I was kind of thinking about changing my business model. And a friend of mine was driving by one day and he said, "Hey, got a second?" I said, "Sure." He goes, "We really need some help. I got to put somebody in at the Royal. You know, we need this somebody for this person." I'm like, "Oh." I'm like, "Really?" I said, "Maybe I'll put my hat in the ring for that." I'm like, "What is it?" He goes, "Oh, it's the horse show." I'm like, "Oh, okay." So I actually just put, yeah, on a whim, did my resume up and threw that in. And then all of a sudden I was being interviewed. I think they had gotten down to the last three, and then I ended up getting that. And that was, you know, April, I was interviewed in March. I think my first start date was April 26th. So from April to October, I not only did the Royal, but I ran my barn, took people to horse shows. So I would take my laptop to the horse shows and I would, you know, muck 8 or 10 stalls at, you know, 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning, lunge horses, get prepare the animals. You know, if I needed to braid one, I needed to braid one. And then I would show a couple of horses like Wednesday, Thursdays in the professional divisions, show some horses, and then take the laptop, go up to the pavilion, get on the Wi-Fi, replies some emails. So that's kind of how it got started. And then October, you know, I gave my clients plenty of time, plenty of notice. But in October of that year, that was 2012, I shut my barn down and then just basically for the Royal and continued on expanding my judging. As a day-to-day, year-to-year thing for the Royal, our cycle is really, it's a full year cycle. So we go down to just a couple of days a week for January, February, March. Like it's basically 3 days a week for me, or two, depending on what kind of time I have. You know, that's the budget cycle. And we're also closing off the fair previous. Okay. And then, you know, at the budget cycle, and I call it fighting for money, not necessarily budgeting, but I call it fighting for money because you want to keep investing in the horse show, right? But the Royals are not for profit. So it's not like it's making a ton of money. That takes us through till May. And then you're hiring entertainment, you're developing the prize list, you're, you know, I'm responsible for the VIP seating, the sky suites, the terrace, that, like, it's a whole thing, right? And that you just kind of working at that every day, sending out contracts to officials, working on the schedule with our show manager Peter Doubleday, right? So all of that stuff goes through. And then September, you know, there's sign orders, there's work orders for the union and union negotiations, and so wow. It goes right through. Yeah. And then the fair, you know, I'm there at 6:30 in the morning generally. And I'm lucky if I'm out of there by 11 or 11:15 at night. Wow. That would be the earliest. Yeah. So it's good. You can go strong for 10 days, but I know now it's harder on me for the 10 days because I'm not as young as I used to be. Yeah.
And for the month, for the rest of November and December, do you just crash?
It's funny you say that because for about 2 weeks after the Royal, like we finish on the Sunday, 2 weeks after that, nobody, my closest friends, I don't hear from them. They know not to talk to me, and they know when I'm ready, I will reach out to them. You know, a lot of people don't think so, but I'm actually an introvert by nature. So I need that rest and recharge. And you have to, I never used to understand that, but you know, I always thought I was an extrovert, and I'm not when it comes right down to it, because I like my time to be by myself and I need that overstimulation to just calm down. So 2 weeks after the Royal, I call my house the compound. I hardly leave the compound. You know, I get groceries and get gas and that is it. You know,
that's awesome. That's good. So, yeah.
A little self-care.
I just want to go back to the beginning of your story, when you said you decided to close up your barn.
There's so much emotion and passion, blood, sweat, tears, everything you described with that. How hard is it? Or how hard was it? Do you look back at it and go, geez, I wonder if I still should, to take that chapter, that huge chapter of your life, and shut it down, close the book. How hard was that?
It was really hard, and I really didn't want to. I was really torn. Like once they gave me the job of the role, I'm like, oh God, I didn't think I was actually going to get it. So now, right? And so for me, it was really hard closing the barn down because honestly, I felt like I'd failed, and so that was a really hard thing to do with because I don't like to fail. I like to always push it across the wire. So that was really hard for me, and I had a horse at the time too, and I still have a horse. But part of that difficulty was putting him and becoming a boarder at another farm, and the care wasn't up to my liking. And but you have to switch your mindset because you don't have say anymore over what paddock that horse goes in necessarily, right? You can ask; they might entertain you, but and the care where he is excellent. But there's certain things that I'm like, oh God. Why do you do that? Stop it. Stop it. So it was hard. It was hard. And I think that the failure was a really bitter pill to swallow because my perception of failure. I don't think anybody would have said it was a failure. I just made a conscious choice, but I was like, ugh.
Well, I think as we get older, that the whole idea of like, so I think back to some activities or hobbies I had that I'm like, huh, maybe I'll get back into that. And I'm like, okay, there's not enough time in the day, to for everything we have to do to go back and relive and bring all of those things forward. And yeah, I mean, life evolves. We
Yeah,
evolve.
it does. It does. And I find, every time I think I want to open a barn again, like I find when I judge a lot of times, and if I'm at a smaller show and I watch what's going on in the schooling ring and watch the lack of knowledge of some of the coaches that are actually, hanging a shingle out and calling themselves a professional, I'm like, oh, I need to get back in. I'm like, this is ridiculous. And I'm like, stop it, stop it. And so, what I do to quaff that desire to get back in is I always freelance teach. I have other coaches that will call me and say, hey, can you come watch these couple of these horses go? I'm not sure if I'm on the right track, and they don't feel threatened by it. I get hired for clinics a lot because they don't feel threatened by me, the coach, because I'm not going to take any customers. I don't do that as a full-time thing anymore. So I teach. I really make a point of still coaching. I make a point of still learning, right? I mean, if you get out of the business, I mean, the technology has changed. You just look at the types of boots now on horses and the FEI boot rules. I had a lot to learn because some of the fancy boots that they have, that help the horses, quote unquote, to jump, are not legal. And so you kind of go, oh my God, I had no idea. And so I had to relearn all of that, which was interesting.
Wow.
Because you're not at it doing it day to day.
Yeah, exactly. Things will change. Yeah. All right, Christine, please talk to me about being a judge. Since you've served as a senior EC judge in Hunter, Jumper, Hack and Equitation at Equestrian Canada, and you hold your level one FEI jumper judge status as well, what kind of mindset shift do you need to embrace when you go from being a coach or a rider to sitting on the other side of the ring?
So the first thing I had to learn as a hunter judge is you cannot have friends in the ring. Like, because we're a small sport, a lot of the smaller shows like Trillium shows, or Silver shows, they can't necessarily afford to fly judges in from the US, right? So, you're getting used for a lot of local shows. So inadvertently, you might know a lot of the people in the ring and you cannot have a friend in there. And I always tell people, I'm so not into favoritism, and I always tell people it's worse to be my friend because I've probably seen you ride your best, and if you're subpar on that day, I'm like, come on, you can do better than this, right? So I have to watch that I don't score them too hard because I know what they're capable of and how good they're capable of being. So that was the first mindset, the mindset shift. And I think as well, I think being a judge makes me a better trainer because the issues in the ring with a lot of horses and a lot of athletes, you see common threads. So when I coach, you know, I always think about the back of my mind what really aggravates me as a judge. So I try and, you know, work really hard to school people and help them, you know, be successful and prepare them for success in the ring.
Okay. What I was thinking with that one, for with your judging, when you're seeing something or you're seeing those common threads that are sort of frustrating you, doesn't that make you want to get out there and do more coaching?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. But, you know, you kind of also have to recognize there's only time in the day for so many things. And, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody. I've, you know, and this year I find, I'll call myself out, I've spread myself too thin. So I've taken on so much judging and so many, you know, small side coaching things that, you know, it's becoming a little difficult to manage, right? And I generally try and front load any judging I do. But, you know, I took some jobs late in the year, and it's causing my anxiety to go up, right? Because I feel like I'm not doing a good enough job over here, and don't let this slide. I feel like the circus lady that's spinning the plates. You gotta keep back and spinning all the plates. That's what I kind of feel like this time of year.
So do you, so if this year you kind of overdid it a little bit, how would you describe your ability to set boundaries generally with how busy your life is?
I'm a terrible boundary setter. I want to do it all, be it all, you know, it's really, really difficult for me to set boundaries. But I've gotten better at it, and I can say no now. You know, I used to drive for 2 hours, teach a lesson for 20 minutes, and then drive home. And I refuse to do that now, and I refuse to do it for, you know, $45, so to speak, right? Whatever that, I'm like, nope, my time's worth more. And I think that's an important boundary I've learned to set.
Yeah. And I think that comes with age and wisdom too, honestly.
Absolutely. And I think you have to realize that your own time, your personal time has a value, has a dollar value per week.
Yeah. And this is the third time our conversation has pivoted slightly to business. So I think it all comes down to that. I mean, the whole, over the years when I've looked at, you know, raising prices or for massaging and stuff, I've talked to some mentors of mine who are, you know, like way up there. They've been doing this forever. And like, they tell me they still struggle with self-worth at setting prices and stuff. And it's like, that's a big jump when you take that trust in your ability and everything that you do and say, okay, this is what I'm charging. And it's like, woo.
Agreed. Agreed.
It's a hard one.
Yeah.
All right, Christine,
for sure.
I'm going to read you this definition. Leadership is the ability to influence people in order to get things done. Meanwhile, self-leadership is the ability to consciously influence your own thoughts and behavior in order to achieve your personal goals or an organization's objectives. How do you differentiate the idea of leadership from self-leadership, and what is so important about the latter?
I think self-leadership is really important. That is what determines your ability to lead a team. To lead, you know, whether it's a group of people or a team or your clients, that's what leads that group to give 110%. So, you know, self-leadership, people appreciate if you're leading by example, I think. And, you know, if you have four grooms that work for you because you have a barn of 25 horses or whatever, don't be afraid to pick up a pitchfork and get in beside them and help them. If they've got a busy day, you know, 20 minutes of work can really make the difference in their day, then you have to, that's being a leader, right? For me, I also like to empower people that I work with. My team at the Royal, I value their opinions. You know, I might not have the same opinion. We might end up going the direction I originally started with, but I kind of, you know, what do you think about this? You know, what are your thoughts on this? Because maybe they bring a different perspective. So I think part of being a leader is the ability to look at all angles and listen to everybody's opinions, and because everybody has a valued thought or a different perspective. And I think that's important. And then, you know, work ethic. A good leader has an extremely good work ethic for me, whether it's, you know, you don't necessarily need to put in 16 hours a day every day, but you need to work smart, and you need to ensure that you're getting done what you need to do, and to create an atmosphere for success wherever you are.
Yeah, your story about McLean sharing a cab with him, that brought up in my brain the whole sense of like his self-leadership in that relationship with his horse. I also like I almost feel self-leadership is could also be called like account self-accountability
100%.
to what you're doing, to your relationships around you, etc. So, instead of passing the buck, McLean was taking that self-leadership of recognizing where things could have been different or changed, etc. I
Yep,
also feel like self-leadership has a lot to do with what we do on the day-to-day when no one's watching.
for sure. I agree. I completely agree. I think, yeah, people, and that again, that goes back to, people standing on the rail in the ring. If you're conducting yourself accordingly, you're actually leading yourself in to success. And people watch that and they see that. And, I always really work hard to inspire, well, inspires may be a strong word, but to lead by example, right? And you want people to kind of try and get that by osmosis just by standing near you. If you can kind of create good, whether it's your actions or your words, I think that's one of the greatest things ever, and then the whole area around you becomes better and better
Yeah.
for everybody.
And I think in those moments of in when you're seen as the leader, you can take those some of those moments and definitely choose to make them a lead by example, hoping to get a message across. I think the fun part about self-leadership is when you are doing the day-to-day, like you said, just putting your best foot forward and doing maybe following some of those values we talked about at the beginning. It's almost like the whole concept of self-leadership isn't even something that needs to be pointed to that that's what's happening. Yeah, it's just like what someone sees you do on a day-to-day basis is just who you are.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed. I couldn't agree
I
more.
love this concept. I think it's something that I don't know if we look into that a little bit more. I don't know. There's a lot of self-growth to be had there too. I think it's kind of cool.
I completely agree with you. I think self-leadership, you shouldn't have to call it out. It should just be.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Okay. Last question here, Christine. What's been the best part of your equestrian experience so far? And what about your future in this sport keeps you excited about remaining involved?
Feel like I'm going to have an existential crisis here talking about it. There really hasn't been a best part. It's the entire journey that's for me that's been the best part. I think it's so cool that, somebody like me, a kid who comes from a family that didn't have a lot of money, nobody in my family has anything to do with horses. I've been able to create something where, by creating opportunities for myself, I think you could say, like, even when I was, 11, 12, 13 years of age, I didn't really have a horse, but I would clean tack. I would groom horses, clean tack, muck stalls, do whatever. I would, work in the garden just to in exchange for lessons. So I created opportunity,
Yes.
for myself. And then, my first job on a horse farm, I basically answered an ad in the paper and lied. I was 16, and they said, "Do you have any experience with thoroughbreds?" And I said, "Yes, I do. I have lots of experience with thoroughbreds off the track." And really, I had, kind of watched one gallop one day at the track, was pretty much done. And they kind of, when I got there, I mean, I knew how to handle the horses and do all of that, but the first thing they asked me to do was, "Here, can you turn out the stallion?" And I said, "Absolutely. Oh, put a chain over his nose." I said, "Yep, no problem." So I did. I put a chain over his nose. I go out to the paddock. And as I unclip, he did that, famous bolt, right? And I'm like, "Oh no, you don't." So I'm like, I'm hanging on, and they were sitting on the porch watching me turn this horse out, and they said, "Oh, we saw your feet hit the ground every third stride of his," because I was just hanging on to the halter. I'm like, no, that's not happening." So I dragged him back and did it again until he actually stopped doing it, right? And then it progressed from there. But I think the opportunities I've had and the opportunities I've created has been amazing. And I think that's how I've become what I consider to be a true horseman. I think if you're a student of the sport for life, you get real value out of what you're doing because there's always something to learn. And for the future, I'm excited about continuing to expand my knowledge base. I don't think any one person knows it all. And I think that's a dangerous thing. If you think you know more than everybody else and you think you're the smartest person in the room, it's a bad, bad thing for you.
Yeah.
I'd like to take my FEI judging role as far as I can. If I could get to, I think I'm a little old maybe to get going, but if I could get to a level four, so you're at that point where you can judge. You can be president of a jury at five-star events. You can be president of the jury at the, World Games, championships, continental championships. That would be amazing. Realistically, I probably have time to get to the level three, and so we'll see how it goes. If I get to four, that would be amazing. But I'm not going to, jump off the cliff if I don't. I will only do that if I don't make three.
Okay. Okay, well, we'll all keep our ears alert on that.
And I, you know what? I want to get a course design card too, and I miss showing. I miss being in the ring. On the docket is to buy myself a horse and to make up and get back in the show ring. So it's probably too much and probably be spreading myself thin, which I do, but it's there's goals there above and beyond what I'm doing right now.
I am you're very inspiring. Yeah.
Well,
No, I love it. And it's that I think the constant urge, that drive to learn more. I'm constantly thinking about, well, what book can I read that's maybe a little different than what I tend to gravitate to? Or what this is what I love about the podcast. I get to have all of these conversations with people such as yourself with wide varieties of experience and knowledge. And I'm like, oh, it's a masterclass for me every time I get this opportunity.
it's, I think we're all fortunate. We can all learn from each other, right?
Yeah.
So I think if we all keep an open mind and be willing to accept different perspectives, I think we can all grow. And that's really what your whole life story is supposed to be about, is your continued growth.
Well, I don't think there's wiser words there to end this conversation. So thank you so much. Yes, you are a very busy woman, and I really, really appreciate your openness to come on here and have a little chat with me and the listeners. If people have any questions for you about, getting into judging or anything about the royal or anything, is there a way anybody can get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of the older people, so I live on Facebook. I'm always on Messenger, easy to find. I'm very happy for, if you want to share my personal email to the world, that's fine as well too.
Okay.
I'm everywhere on WhatsApp, and I really actually enjoy helping people. Like, one of my favorite things is when I have shadow judges in the booth with me.
Oh, nice.
I really help them develop their own sense, of how to bookkeep, how to, what a good horse looks like. So I really enjoy helping people get their cards and stuff. It's fulfilling to me.
Well, it's paying it forward. It's an important part. Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome, Christine. Well, thank you again, and you enjoy that cruise you're headed on.
I will. I'm very excited. So thank you.
Thank you.
So there you have it. I have some great interviews lined up for future episodes, and we'll be covering some pretty interesting topics, as always, with the intent to open and engage the horse world on a wide variety of issues. So until next time, keep your eyes forward and continue to hit your stride. To stay current with hitting your stride, subscribe on my website or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. If you like what you've heard here today, make sure you share and leave a comment to help guide future episodes and widen the audience. And be sure to check out social media to keep up to date with Equestrian Elements Life Coaching.